Okay.
Okay. Well, the district started, as I say, the early people were 84, you know, people kicking tires. Mm-hmm. But it got a little more serious. We staked all of Porcupine and the ridges and everything else for Hard Rock. 186 claims, Henry and I, in 86 with the Horners, George and Joanne, or the George Horner Trust, that was the actual part. Because we had found a hot spot that over, and we knew about the anticline by then because Steve Masterman's thesis was out. And what we had had was Bonanza and Porcupine's intersected a V. And then there's a ridge that runs down. The anticline comes up Porcupine and goes under on our side of the ridge. And the dome is up here a little bit more to Bonanza. But Porcupine comes off of it too. And AMAX had had a crew doing a recon. But let's try sequence time-wise. 84 people are kicking tires and they're beginning to find samples and hopes of continuity. Things are happening. Fort Knox is getting started. There's interest in lower grade deposits, or by now everybody's, no matter how slow we are, we have figured out about heap leach in Nevada. And, you know, a whole bunch of stuff is going on and suddenly makes the possibility look better. And there have always been hot samples. And there's always been gold. Paul Metz finds what he calls the Bonanza sequence over on Bonanza. Rudy Vedder goes over and stakes some hard rock on Bonanza. And I can't remember the name of the two brothers, but they were going up something called Rebel Creek and ran into hard rock samples off of Bonanza. So, and that's the south end for us. Off on Porcupine Dome, we're going upstream. And we're getting coarser and coarser gold. And when the Cathro and Entwiler are up to visit, we're talking about how many implantations there have been, how many events, that if depositional events are involved here. I said, well, I was showing them some of our gold, and giving them some samples to take back to Denver. And I said, we have old gold and new gold. And of course, I was thinking of the shinier stuff as the new gold and the moldier looking stuff as the old gold. And Jack said, yes, you do, but you got it wrong. The old gold is the shiny stuff. And he said, and you've got more than two. He said, I can see at least three distinct events in this spread. About that time, Asarco. Paul Metz gets hold of Asarco to look at the Bonanza thing. And through some, which nobody ever figured out how this happened, but they overstaked me, Fairbanks X. They took care of it, fixed it too. And they advertised it for joint venture. And Hecla got involved and showed up. This is 88. Because I already had hard rock claims. So, not many. But we definitely had all the placers. And we had them covered with state claims. So we had a fair holding up there. And Hecla comes up, kicking tires. And they, of course, find the ownership conflict right away. And after they first told me that I didn't know what I was talking about, they backed off and said, can we make a deal? About that time, John Gailey Bob Burrell, Bill Duncan, and Dave Zumagawa arrive in the district, and they're doing recon for AMEX. They're done up here, you know, at Fort Knox. That's a project moving forward. And they came up. John Gailey was the first one. He came up. He was on a recon trip with Kurt Friedman and Kelly Dolphin. And we meet on the Porcupine Creek Road, and he said, "Can we come up to camp?" And I said, "Yes," and look, and they did. And by now, I'm staking. I mean, there's no, well, I'm staking around my hot spots. My everybody's walking up the creek and breaking visible gold. I've got a staking crew out. And so that started, now you're seeing senior exploration geologists in the field actually kicking tires. Not just us placer guys that are trying to find some hard rock and aren't exactly sure what we're looking for. And they're also talking theories. And this is where this Tatita fault business starts to really play, because as this thing that develops, it's the next 10 years are kind of important on it. You've got NERCO, and then their joint venture, right in the middle of this, 88 or so, the state kicks in and they start charging 6i. Well, NERCO and Western Australia dropped the ball between themselves. Each of them thought the other one had paid 6i, and 6i didn't get paid, and their claims got dropped. Well, when they dropped the ones on Deadwood and the ones on Table Mountain are my country, and I found it accidentally at the recorder's office that those claims were open, which I couldn't believe. I already had claims next to NERCO on Deadwood. I called George. We put prospect sites on them the next day. And then we incorporated. So we picked up that right away because I knew something about it. And it was serendipity. I was trying to get a machine to warm up at the old recorder's office where you waited for things to warm up. And I was bored while I was doing this because I had to wait for somebody else on the next thing. And the only thing there to read was the state's drop list. So I mean, or the telephone book. So I was reading the drop list. Not a good explanation, but that's how it happened. So I've got two properties in the circle area. The one is over on Deadwood, that's the Bittner, and the NERCO, the old NERCO property. But let's stay over on Porcupine because that was the grassroots development. While the AMAX people were doing their recon, it was really over on the Deadwood stuff area that was their directed recon. But Bob Morrell and John Gailey had been up to camp a couple of times, and they were really, and Bill Duncan, were all interested in this little area, my hot spot, where Hecla had been. So they came up on Sundays and ate spaghetti and things like that and put a grid in. And then this was over a period, I got about 4 AMAX reports every year, a little bit got done. And then we had enough data, they had enough data, and I had a cat and an operator that were, this hit by now Henry has died. I had a cat and an operator that were done for the season. We had to wait a week or a week and a half before we could do something else. And so I sent him up to dig a trench. And Duncan came up for a couple of days. And Carolyn, and we called it a vacation, and we were all out on the trench And we got an intersection, just like you would expect with guidance like that. So now we've got a trench, and we've got an intersection, and we've got great samples, and I can send a geologist up, and they'll bring visible gold, and I can't get a deal anywhere. The price of gold is sinking like a rock. Remember when it went up and then it went down and it went down? At one point, Battle Mountain was out there. And they were so excited, they came into town, hired Steve Masterman before he... And they were out there for 2 weeks. The guys on the field, William Morgan and Masterman, are saying, make a deal. Mm-hmm. Bill Ellis is saying, make a deal. We have all the paper. The deal came. On one hand, Anchorage was saying your check is in the mail. And on the other hand, we're getting a phone call from Arizona, I think, was where they were, saying we're closing the Alaska office.
Yeah.
We did not get a deal. We continued to nurture this and placer, just keep on placer mining. Mm-hmm. And take a few more samples and do a little this and get someone else out to look at it. But you I mean, there was a point there. They were going to close Fort Moxie at one point. The state saved that. Mm. They refied. Mm. Because there, I got them some ADEM industrial lower interest money. Mm. But they couldn't get Fort Knox open. And that would have been devastating to this community.
Yeah.
Okay. So now we can't get a deal. We got a lot of claims. We can't get a deal if Six Eye is killing them.
Yeah.
But we kept on plastering. A little bit. I mean, you have to do enough to do annual labor. And then a friend of ours that we worked with for years, and who would rather prospect than mine any day of the week, Wayne Pepler Sr. Good prospector. Good miner. But if he sees a prospect, he'd rather prospect than he forgets. He chases the prospect. But he's a Californian, right? He's been mining as long as we have. He was out in the 70 mile when we went to Porcupine. He's got claims with over on Mary Louise, and he's mined a lot. Worked for Fort Knox. Anyway, he was the placer. And you get gold when you placer. He worked for us a couple of times. You get gold when you placer on Porcupine. So Joanne and I made it police. And first thing that happens, first year, he had something interesting. And he brought in some rocks. 19 or 20, they're still on the back porch. Splits. And by now, I've gotten a little wiser about how you interest a company. So I called Arnie and said, you know, I have a few samples from Porcupine. And they're different. Would you like, by any chance, could you run them for me? And about 3 months later, I got a contact from David Poole, and he said, here's your sample results. How much of this stuff do you have? Do you have any more of it? And I said, I think I've got a whole hillside of it. The next year, Pepler goes out, and he's going upstream. All of a sudden, we hit something much different, way different. About 200 feet of it exposed in the bedrock. And I've got, that's the rock garden over here. samples in and PAM specimens. It's not quiet interest, but by then, Joanne and I had been sued. And by Ron Brooks over trying to dissolve the corporation that we had over on Deadwood. And we were both a little bit gun-shy about pulling into a deal or starting anything till we found out what the lay of the land was. So I called Arnie and invited them up for lunch. Just come on up to Porcupine for lunch. Hmm. And of course he'd seen me coming, all of some rocks. And four four-wheelers, eight geologists, and Arnie arrived for lunch. With their fizz bottles and all. And after that, the story was, how do you write the contract?
That's great.
You see, the property ownership between the two properties is different. For what? George and Joanne and Henry and I had always owned Porcupine in joint venture. There'd never been anybody else in involvement. Over on the Bittner, which used to be NERCO's Discovery Gulch project, over on the Bittner, George and I had, and Ron Brooks had incorporated. And so when George died, well, Henry died first. No, Henry was dead then. When George died, and Ron hadn't participated in the corporation for 5 years. I mean, he just wasn't significantly participating in any way. And Joanne and I were paying these bills, 6i, and it wasn't cheap because we had a lot of claims. We had 6i, and we had annual labor, and it was kind of remote, which meant it was a hassle every year to do a reasonable amount of labor, and Brooks was doing nothing, and he was paying nothing. So we asked, I mean, it was kind of like, we talked to the corporate attorney, and we said, can we quit? Can we just drop this ground? He said, are you kidding? He'll sue you so fast you can't believe it. It's a valuable asset. Mm. Maybe. Well, what can we do? So we paid it another year. Now, she's got money, but I didn't. I mean, I've never been affluent. I was always the one that, you know, bootstrapped her way into the mining business.
Yeah. Yeah.
And this was ridiculous. It was costing us $14,000 or $15,000 a year. And we couldn't do anything with it. We couldn't show it. We couldn't even find Ron. So we finally got a trace of where we're up. And there, we talked about it with the attorney, and he said, we need to have a corporate meeting. And so we did. But you also need to have some idea what you would like to have happen. So we proposed to dissolve the corporation, which had all of $485 and owed a lot of money to us, basically, but it owed money because we paid all those bills. You see, once George died, we've had a two-check system. I couldn't write a check even. We couldn't put money in the corporate account and then pay it, you know, like a capital investment, was not possible because if you put it in the account, you couldn't get it out. Joanne wasn't even a director. So we had two out of three directors alive and only one of them carrying water. But now we're getting ready to make a deal with Kinross, and when I'm looking at the situation over, which we've got this in joint venture, and we've got this corporate mess over here, and we didn't want the two to get enmeshed. That's what Ron wanted. was to get close to that deal. So we incorporated an LLC on just the Porcupine property and made the deal with that LLC, which had no interest in the other deal. So this has been one of the wilder business juggling events.
Yes.
Making sure that you know when you're the old joint venture, when you're WBH, and when you're the LLC.
Yeah.
And Kinross made it through that whole problem just without even, it took us an hour and a half to make it. They wanted to make it. They did what basically we wanted. We wanted to make it. They said, well, should we meet at Sourdough Sam's? We said, no. Why don't we meet at our office? You bring the donuts.
So what's happening out there? You talked about them improving the road.
Okay. We had one of the historic, I mean, it's a road of which legends are made. Like I was stuck for a week on the Porcupine Creek Road. Our road has always been an interesting disaster. Well, of course, after the fires in 2004, like everybody else, we were running into the mudslides and filled up culverts. And it's a deeded state road. It actually was deeded to the state at the time of statehood. So it's a good, solid state road. However, they don't maintain it. And Kinross, as usual, I called the state. How about some help with the road? We've got the possibility of getting a major company interested. The state said, we'll be out there to ride the road with them. And they did. The state took the first 6 miles. Kinross took the second 6 miles. And they both went to work on the road so you could get in and out of there. At one point last year, I just didn't go up. I refused to go up and be a pain in the. But the road was so bad that they had a telephone down at the worst spot so that if you did get stuck, they'd send somebody from camp down to get you. Well, I'm not going on a social visit if I'm going to disrupt them and have the camp cook running down to get me out of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, that just wasn't there. And, of course, we have a plaster operator up there now, too, and another one. And he gets along well with Kinross. We've actually got two up there now because when we made the deal, we were left the plaster rights, to lease the plaster. And of course, so that's been another little negotiation. They're wonderful to do business with. They've been very good neighbors to the community in Central. That's no surprise.
Yeah.
And
you said they had a camp?
Last year they had a big camp. This year I don't think they're doing a big camp. Last year they were doing some drilling. And they took in one of Tiger's camps. And I still have a camp up there. It's rather old-fashioned. But it's shelter. And, I mean, there's a stove, there's a cookhouse, sort of. Things have fallen into, I wouldn't say neglect, they've fallen into light-fingeredness the last few years. I've noticed there's a lot more. I just had my equipment on Pedro vandalized. Yeah. Pish.
Mm.
Pshaw.
Yes. Yeah.
It's okay.
So like they had like 40 people out there or something like that?
Mm-hmm. 24, I think their report said. They were going to put in a 40-man camp. I think they put in a 20-man camp on the end. I thought it was going to. I read the report they sent me. And it wasn't. They spent a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they're out there this year.
Okay.
They don't have as big a program. They didn't have that style program. I don't know, have no idea what they're doing, but they didn't have that style program set up for this year. I think my interpretation of what I think they're doing and what they're doing may be very different. I think they're stepping out from the zones that they felt were ready to drill and looking for some other things. A couple of them were things that I knew about, and one of them was something I pointed out, some old trenches up on a hill, which I'm sure they knew about too by then. I don't think I contribute much in new knowledge, but there was a theory years ago from a guy named Bill Davies, who was a geologist for probably USGS Washington, D.C. He was a military geologist. And he had been down in Peru when they had one of those great big rocks that was on a hill that was threatening to fall, be huge boulder things, and they had to see whether it was going to come down and just wipe out the only road in the area and things like that. Structural geologist. And I don't know why he was a porcupine. Henry and I were there. And then we were in the old cookhouse, so it was before the 80s. It was in the 70s, I'm sure. But he was doing something. Maybe military telegraph, you know, whatever he was looking at. But when he came up to camp, he said, "You realize you're on a little plate that's docking here." "Oh, we're in the middle of the interior of Alaska. What do we mean you were? We're on a plate." You wouldn't think of being on a tectonic plate out there. And I mentioned that to Arnie Bakke, and he said, "How do you know that?" And I said, "Well, I don't know it. I was told this by somebody I think had a lot of credibility." And he said, "Do you happen to know who that was?" And I said, "I know the name." He said, "It's most interesting because from what I've seen, it might be true." And that would go along with some of these other things that are happening. It's a very interesting and active area structurally. The first time Ernie Wolf was up there, he walked up Yankee Creek. And I had to have a sample, a float, naturally. But it was float with a lot of visible gold. I mean, it wasn't a small nugget, it was float. But there was bismuth gold, and so I walked up Yankee Creek with Ernie to look at where I thought I got this piece of float, and we'd knock a little rock around and see if we could find out where it came from. And he was showing me this, and he said, "Well, you know, you've got four folding vents here." I mean, so it's been a very structurally active spot.
Yeah.
I mean, it must have been, because there's also on a Helen Foster report, you know how they might show deep faults as versus just little faults, really deep faults? And this one, most of the faulting is
northeast,
or it's 45 degrees. I mean, it makes almost, it's like a parallelogram.
Mm.
Against some of the visible things. It's very interesting. Milt Wiltsy, when they did that great big structural digital satellite mapping stuff, the magnetics, resistance, and...
magnetics and resistance. Electromagnetic, but I think that was it.
No, there were three things involved.
Radiometric?
Well, whatever. I don't know. I've got it here somewhere handy. I sent it out of order, so naturally I'm going to get it wrong. But when they did that, resistivity, geomagnetics, and... Well, for the moment, moment. It's not in my head. They had come across that there were these blocks, lots of block activity.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sliced and diced, I think they called it.
Okay. Well, that it was. And then, not in alignment with the block, the slicing and dicing, were these deep folds of Helen Foster's. And someone else who worked with her, this is much earlier, this is 78 or so.
Makes sense.
Yeah. But again, there's this map, and that's default for pointing right where we're going.
Yeah.
So I don't know, but I always thought the structural fascinated me.
Me too. Do you want to show me your rocks, by the way?
They're all out.
Well, I mean, just, you know, I mean, as a kind of an ending of the...
How's about I bring you some?
Oh, bring me some.
Yes.
Oh.
Because I've got some, I think I've got some that are even sliced.
Oh.
Not polished yet, but sliced.
Mm-hmm.
But let me get you a nice cross-section. I had a rock library. Well, that's one of the things I established at Porcupine was a rock library.
Oh, right.
Every geologist that visited, John Gailey started it.
Nice idea.
He came in and he had little sample slips with a number on them so that when the report came back, I would have the rock to show that went with it.
Yes.
Well, once he established that standard, every other geologist that went on recon, I expected them to bring me rocks.
Yeah.
So I kept a rock library right in the cookhouse.
Mm.
So if somebody dropped in, I'd have something to show. You know, I would have a few reports and numbers and maps and some rocks.
That's great.
That was the right idea, wasn't it?
Yeah.
George said I was a born saleswoman.
You
can't call them up and say we'd like to talk about doing a deal because you've got a little legal problem, but you can call them up and ask them to lunch.
Yeah.
I just put all the rocks off the porch out into the
garden
the other day. Did Travis Frisson is to break their neck out there. And the ones out here I'm not showing until I wash them. Because that was the dog's poop and pee porch one day. Not this dog, but the one before. And I want to make sure all the rocks have been washed.
Sure. Yeah.
That would be me.
Yeah.
Yes, but the stories from which legends are made, right?
Yes. That's really the best thing. Yeah.
Oh, I think that I think Circle District is going to bloom. I really do. And I can recall with such confidence saying, well, at least there's one thing we don't have to worry about in the Circle District. If we finally figure out where it's coming from, I'm sure we'll make grade.
You'd be the first to help that along, I think.
We're working on it.
Yeah.
And now, on the other side, but I can't really talk about this quite yet, because we don't have our legal decision, but on the other side, out of those 3,000 acres that I had owned before, I have discovered, in going through the old paperwork files, that I've got 5 drill holes. Now they were drilled when gold was down, and nobody was interested. But they are very close to and have got a property I've still got an interest in. And it turns out that I'm on very good terms with some of my neighbors who said, if you start to put something together, rather than get something splintered out here and then nothing ever goes anywhere, when you start to put something together, give us a call and we'll bring ours to the table too.
That's my idea.
Well, it's not easy for the companies anymore. Everybody always says, well, they're the big boys, they got the money. But there's also an expectation that they can do so much more than an individual can. I mean, people get mad at little individual miners and speak, well, he's got to clean up his water, he's got to do this, or he's got to do that. But it's kind of like life is practical. Sometimes you can ask someone to do something they can't do. I mean, it's either, sometimes there's not an engineering solution that's immediately handy. Quite frequently, there's no solution that's economic with anywhere within the range of the ability of the operator. But when the bigger companies are involved, whether they're at fault or not, even if it's the same kind of there is no solution or it was an act of Mother Nature, everybody expects them to make it, to fix it and make it good. I can recall having a young man from BLM at our placer operation. And it was when they were inspecting for reclamation. So we've got to be talking 80s. And it was after dinner time because I was running the operation. That kind of makes it 80s, late 80s. And this guy, he was a recreationist. He's up just riding around the district with someone else, which is fine. And we hit an artesian spring in the middle of the creek, in the middle of our cut. And of course we were having an episode of some kind. And he said, well, you've got to do something about it. And I said, we have tried several things. We didn't realize we had an artesian spring at first. We thought we had some other kind of water problem. It became very quickly apparent that there was nothing that we were going to do about this. And he said, well, we're going to have to call the EPA. His mouth was running 27. And I said, I've got an idea. I said, first of all, why don't we stop for just a second with your carving here? Do you have a solution? Do you have an idea or a recommendation? Either of you. Sue Wills was there. Sue, do you, and I think his name is Kelly, do you guys have a suggestion? I said, because what is unfortunate about this, as we see it, is the only thing we're going to be able to do is get past it and then cap it. That seems to be the only thing that we can think of to do. We have tried diverting the water, we've tried controlling it, and I said, we haven't had a success yet. And little motor mouth got started again, and I said, I've got an idea. This to me appears to be an act of God. Get on your knees and join me, and we'll pray and see if we can get God to remove this act. And you see, as we were small, what were we going to do? We had no idea. We couldn't build a cofferdam because it was already in full run. And I said, I'll bet you that if you just get out of the way and keep your mouth shut for about 24 hours, by the next time you come out, you won't have any evidence of it. We'll get past it and we'll cap it. Sue decided she was writing the reclamation report, but she wasn't including this whole episode. But it's hard for the companies, in my mind, the expectations. Everybody wants them to operate efficiently, but not meanly. Don't be too cheap. we really like it better if you bought your supplies, you know, in the small communities around you. They want them to, since resources are a state, everybody should be paying the maximum amount of tax. And we kind of got to balance that against this concept that we're a capitalistic country and the stockholders or shareholders are supposed to get something too. And we would expect, since you're a big company, that you're going to be generous with the local community and support all of the local community functions. Plenty of scholarships for the kids to go to school. Aren't you going to donate to every camp, every cause that comes up? And then everybody from your company should wear a logo so that we can tell that you guys are nice, even if no matter who else isn't being nice. And then while you're at it, get in one of the riskiest businesses in the world to try to make a profit.
Yes. No, not easy.
No, it isn't. And I think that it has to be fair as to their expectations.
Yeah. Well, that's one of the reasons I'm writing this, is to show how things are rather than how they're portrayed badly or rosy or whatever, but just objectively. Trying to say, this is how Alaska's developing. And we need these companies. I mean, they do a great job.
Well, I look, when I get so angry when people really get, you know, like the oil companies or the enemy. Mm-hmm. I was here in the 60s. And we had $1 per mile per year for maintenance. Because the feds didn't pay for maintenance. You got 90 cents out of a dollar for construction was federal money. But maintenance was $1 state. And so there wasn't any maintenance. They'd be out here building new road. And you're going over something like this.
Yeah, yeah.
I can remember going in and asking the highway department after something out of Central. What on earth were they spending money building new road when they weren't taking care of what they had? And Woody Johansson heard me ask the question. He came out from his office and he said, I wish I could give this to the people. We do that because we get 90 cents of federal money, which is the only source of money we've got. And we have to spend a dollar of our own money. But the only way we can get that 90 cents to spend the dollar is to keep on building new
mm-hmm.
roads.
Yeah.
And I did, you know?
Oh, yeah. The 60s, yeah. Now, the state was so poor.
Yes, we were. And we had personal income tax. They went and looked in your windows to see what you owned. They had property tax. We didn't have a lot of benefits. We didn't have welfare benefits and stuff like that. And we could barely do the administrative things we had to do.
Yeah.
We were poor.
I was working for the Bureau of Indian Affairs as a teacher in those days. I know what it was like poor, you know, villages. The state couldn't afford education.
Oh, I know. It was terrible.
Yeah. So things changed, which was really wonderful.
And the oil companies weren't the enemy. I don't think people realized how much of a contribution that developed. But the other thing they don't seem to realize is that the oil was there. Yeah, we had the oil. And it wasn't doing anything for us. And I always call it the comparison between potential energy and kinetic energy. Mm. When there's lots of potential energy out there. Anytime you look at a little waterfall, you've got potential. But you don't have any usable electricity.
Yeah.
Until you harness or develop that potential. So in essence, for the people that were living in the state of Alaska, at the time the oil was not leased or under development, the oil was worthless. It produced nothing for them. And I just don't, I mean, I like to look at this when they, we know how dependent, we know we're very dependent. We built a structure that depends on income. And everybody wants to say that, well, we'll just anytime we need more money, we'll just raise the tax on the oil companies. And then wonders why, and we've got the oil, so they'll have to come here. Well, that's not true. And then we may find someday that our oil is like a buggy whip. If they develop an alternative source of energy,
like baleen was buggy whip. We agree on these things, honestly.
I know, and but I try to figure out some way to explain them to people that aren't in the industry.
Mm.
Like, the difference, we're doing it to our children, too. They don't have the education anymore. Half of them wouldn't know the difference between potential and kinetic energy.
Yeah. Right. I've been curious about your ring.
Ah.
I mean, I noticed your ring. So that's what I wanted to ask. Oh, it's got a diamond.
Well, now there's three stories.
That's great looking. Oh,
Henry designed the setting and carved it. I had the first nugget we ever got. My engagement ring.
Uh-huh.
I got that 5 years after we got married.
Yeah.
Well, we had the nugget, but